Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on homedepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at homedepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code BEDBATH15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit homedepot.com for more information.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about current options in egg donation, a question we get a lot of from many of you, so I know you're going to enjoy it. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
We've migrated, I guess, from a time when sort of quote-unquote traditional donor egg, where things were synchronized with the recipient. So, and what I mean by that is, eggs were retrieved, eggs were fertilized, and then the recipient, who would be the intended parent, as we now say, would be on a course of medication to be able to synchronize or time the appropriate transfer of an embryo. So we are finding we're doing less and less of that.
The show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am your host and the director of Creating a Family. You can find us and all of our resources online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. For women who have been undergoing fertility treatment and are still struggling to conceive, there are so many daily scenarios and interactions that take a toll on their emotional health. There is an app for that. It's called Ferticom, and it's an app for both Apple and Android phones, and it was developed by Dr. Ali Domar and Dr. Elizabeth Grill. Many of you will know, Ali and Liz have been on the show, but Dr. Domar has been on many times, and we love her insight, and she has poured her insight into this app. It was designed for women to address the many challenges that come up, and they address like 500 different coping options. So it's really useful, and it's free, and you can get it at FerticomApp.com. That's FerticomApp.com. Today we're going to be talking about current options in egg donation. We're going to be talking with Dr. Joe Massey. He is a reproductive endocrinologist with Servie Massey Fertility Institute in Atlanta and co-founder of the Egg Donation Collaborative. He also has been a long-term friend of Creating a Families. He is a personal friend of mine, and he's served on our board for years, and so we are thrilled to have Dr. Massey back. We also have Dr. Ronald Feinberg. He is a reproductive endocrinologist and the director of the IVF programs at Reproductive Associates of Delaware, and he is the co-founder of the Egg Donor Collaborative. Welcome, Dr. Massey and Dr. Feinberg, to Creating a Family. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you, Dawn.
All right. Well, we usually try to start at the beginning. Now, most of our audience, quite frankly, is well aware of egg donation, and this is a topic that we do cover fairly frequently. However, I think it's always helpful. We get new people dropping in all the time, and some of them are, many of them, I should say, are at the very beginning of their infertility journey, and so many of them have never even given much thought to egg donation. So let's start kind of at the beginning. Dr. Massey, so who is egg donation primarily used for treating infertility?
I guess the first easy answer for who needs egg donation is the group of women who are at the high end of reproductive life, upper end of reproductive life, let's just say 43 to 45 or even older, who are thinking about trying to get pregnant using assisted reproduction. And those in that age group, it's fairly well known that the success rate from IVF can be really low. There are exceptions to that rule, but generally success rates can start getting into the under 10% range, depending on how the woman is. The other factor or the other group, though, are those women who are younger, and they might even be in their 20s or mid-30s, who are found to have low, what we call low ovarian reserve or diminished ovarian reserve. People who are web savvy sometimes find DOR, they Google DOR and they find people chatting about it, and they pretty well know what it's all about.
Some people also call it premature menopause. We hear people, I don't think the medical community likes that term, but we hear patients talking about premature menopause, so I throw it out there. I interrupted you, Joe. Sorry.
Well, that's fine. Yeah. Obviously, if they have gotten to the point that they've stopped periods, then there's no choice. It's not a decision. If they're amenorrheic because they have premature menopause, or even, yeah. So, but the ones I'm talking about are still having periods, and something else is telling them and their doctors that they need to think about egg donation. So, the DOR people are having periods, but they have the low AMH, and I know you've talked about AMH on your program before.
Yep.
But just very briefly, it's a blood test.
Tell us what it is. Mm-hmm.
Blood test that predicts a woman's ovarian reserve or how many eggs she has. Now, but the other way people find out that they need egg donor is they try assisted reproduction, IVF, and they get 3 eggs or less and 1 embryo that doesn't look so good, or even embryos that look good but they don't get pregnant. And their doctors are telling them that their odds of success if they try again are low.
Mm-hmm.
So then the discussion turns to egg donation as an option.
But Joe, let me ask you a question. You said, as far as the age, you said kind of the 43 to 45 range. And I had 2 questions about that. How often is it used in the 40 to 43? Because we hear from that's a real common age range for people to be finding us and asking us questions on that. So what is the general?
Well,
why not the 40?
How much does it
increase your odds of success if you're 40 to 43, let's say? And I realize that it's dependent by the person, of course, but
let's talk
generality.
So you can, if you just take the age group in general, I was sort of using the 43 to 45 as the most obvious age group, but many more people are in our offices who are in that 40 to 43 group, and so there's lots of people in that category.
And it would increase, and the odds.
But okay, so let's just say a good ballpark number might be 43-year-olds getting pregnant at 8%, and 41-year-olds getting pregnant at 12% successful pregnancies. So,
and this
12,
is with
15,
IVF. This
12
is not
15,
natural. This is with IVF.
12 and 15%. Yeah. What's your statistic, Ron, in your center for 41-year-olds?
Yeah, I was just going to bring Dr. Feinberg in here.
I would imagine it's somewhere in the 10 to 20% range, but it's kind of all over the place because it's often limited by how many cycles someone is able to do, what sort of egg production they're having from any given cycle that they do. The good news, this is not on the topic of egg donation, but for women that are in their early 40s, if they are able to produce a chromosomally normal embryo, they have a similar success rate to women who are younger. So it really, for those women, it gets to the point where if IVF really isn't successful for them, then moving on probably makes sense, or considering egg donation makes sense. It's interesting, though, from a historical point of view, that it wasn't always obvious that egg donation would ever be successful. Both Joe and I certainly remember the time when the original cycles of egg donation were carried out. The original paper that was published on the first 2 cases of egg donation, it was actually in women in their 20s who suffered from a lack of ovarian function completely. And because if you think about it, an egg coming from a different person and a sperm coming from a different person. We're essentially creating an embryo that's genetically distinct from the person that's going to carry the pregnancy. And while we take it for granted now that it's a fairly successful approach, no one knew what the ramifications would be. So it was one of those aha moments in reproductive medicine when we
That's
could.
That's fascinating to think about, isn't it, now? I mean, because we do take it for granted now, but you're right. You're, you know, in a normal, you know, I'm really not giving it much thought, but in a normal pregnancy, the fetus and the embryo, and then the fetus is half genetically connected to the mother, and so it's perhaps seen as less alien by the woman's body. So I guess that there was some concern at the beginning that the woman's body would reject. That's fascinating, yeah.
Well,
it makes
plus,
sense. Yeah.
If you think about all people that have organ transplants, and you can't just pluck an organ from one person and stick it into another without doing a lot of cross-matching of certain antigens and using anti-rejection medications and things like that. So it's amazing that we can do what we do and that it works as frequently as it does and that we don't run into those issues.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it's actually spurred a lot of research into understanding how does the uterus really work? How does the uterus really accept early embryo implantation, whether the egg came from, you know, the person that is carrying the pregnancy or whether the egg came from, you know, an egg donor. So, and along those lines, as kind of an offshoot, we do a fair number of cycles of embryo adoption and embryo donation. It's kind of the same sort of magical, mystical, you know, question. How does that even work? Mm-hmm. But it does. So it's nice to keep. Yeah,
it is. It's good to keep the miracle aspect at least in mind. Although I realize that you medical guys don't necessarily grow with the miracle thing, but nonetheless, there is something kind of wonderful about the whole thing working. And that's
Absolutely.
A good segue into a question that we received from Aaliyah. I was going to save it for later, but it's too good a segue not to use it now. She says, my husband is a positive blood type. I'm Rh negative blood type. And I'm told that I have to have a shot to help my body accept the baby conceived with my husband, especially if we have a second child. How will this change if we end up using an egg donor? So her blood type is Rh negative. Her husband is Rh positive. Dr. Feinberg, can you tell me how would this, does that have any impact on egg donation?
I mean, hopefully she's not proceeding with egg donation only because of that issue. But to my understanding, it really shouldn't matter. If she chose a donor who is Rh positive, which most donors would be, she would still require her Rogam injection at different times during the pregnancy. But to my knowledge, maybe Joe knows something I don't, but I'm not aware that should dampen the potential outcome.
No, it shouldn't. No, it wouldn't affect the outcome.
All right, let's get back to egg donation. So just briefly, what is the medical process for the donating woman, Dr. Massey?
The egg donor has to be pretty brave, and that's one of the elements of all of this. She's got to be willing to go through all the injections that the regular infertility patients go through, 10 days, let's say, of injections, monitoring frequently with blood tests and ultrasound tests, a good bit of time involved in that. And she's got to be willing to be put to sleep and have a needle put through the vagina under ultrasound guidance into the ovary and have the eggs collected. I think the biggest side effect from that that's common is that I tell patients it bruises the ovaries because in essence that's what happens. They get several puncture sites in the ovaries and they just are uncomfortable for a few days. That's the typical thing. Mm-hmm. So it's usually managed with mild analgesics. They do have a risk. It's gotten to be a very small risk now, probably 1 or 2% still in donors, but not a very high risk. But a few donors, despite all of our precautions, will get overstimulated, and there's a syndrome of hyperstimulation that can, in very unusual cases, make the donor pretty sick with ovaries that are, let's just say, the size of a cantaloupe or grapefruit. So that's an extreme, but the common, even the common elements of all this donation process are don't lend themselves to people just jumping up and saying, I want to do this, I want to do this. They have to have an element of giving, making a gift, I think is the way I look at it, to somebody else to be willing to do this, even though they're paid. There's an element of altruism, I think, in these donors, and they want to help people have a family. A lot of them actually have knowledge of somebody who has infertility, family, friends, so they understand the trials and tribulations for the recipients.
And Dr. Feinberg, what is the medical process for the recipient to receive once the egg has been fertilized? And we're going to talk about different options there. But once the egg has been fertilized, what is the medical process for the woman who is going to be receiving the donated egg that has been fertilized and is now an embryo?
Well, a lot of it depends on the patient's desires as far as, and there's so many different combinations of options. Some of the same options that would be occurring in, you know, someone doing their own IVF cycle. For example, eggs could be frozen, so maybe they're not even going to be used right away. Or the eggs could be fertilized and embryos can be created, and the embryos could be frozen because perhaps they're not going to be used right away. Along those lines, there's increasing interest in chromosome testing of embryos, even those created from donor egg. So in that setting, an embryo would typically be grown to the blastocyst stage and biopsied for chromosome testing and frozen. And I know that's not addressing the question you asked me, but all of that's important to know because ultimately it might impact when the embryo gets placed back into the woman's uterus.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I think it's important to point out is one of the most rapidly growing utilizers of donor eggs right now and for building a family is men. And men are uterine challenged. I don't think most men would feel insulted if they were told they were uterine challenged, which means many men that are looking to build a family from egg donation may have to either identify or coordinate things with a gestational carrier in order for the whole cycle to be potentially successful. So I think we've gone, we've migrated, I guess, from a time when sort of quote-unquote traditional donor egg, where things were synchronized with the recipient. So, and what I mean by that is, eggs were retrieved, embryos, eggs were fertilized, and then the recipient, who would be the intended parent, as we now say, would be on a course of medication to be able to synchronize or time the appropriate transfer of an embryo. So we are finding we're doing less and less of that. So what I mean by synchronization is, the woman who's going to be carrying the pregnancy would typically be on a course of estrogen to prepare her uterine lining. And assuming the uterine lining is developing the way we'd like based on ultrasound pattern, she would then be prescribed some progesterone on top of the estrogen. And with that, we're counting on the embryo being ready to be transferred. Typically, that would be a fresh embryo transfer. But we've gotten away from that a lot because of all these different permutations and combinations of what can be done with embryos. But the
doesn't the recipient still usually have the estrogen and progesterone, or are you moving to doing natural cycles because you're following her natural cycle and not using additional support.
Exactly. That's what I was leading to, is that once an embryo is frozen, you actually have more flexibility in how you might want to handle the actual timing of the embryo transfer. And there's been good data over the years that if a woman is cycling normally, that the chances of achieving a pregnancy with a natural cycle versus a medicated cycle may well be quite similar. There's some inconvenience to counting on a natural cycle. That particular month may not go well. All of the hands on deck that you might need at the clinic may not be available on the day that you'd want to do the transfer. So it's a little more predictable to be able to do a medicated cycle, but there's all different combinations now of how frozen embryo transfers can be done. And I suspect most clinics are not synchronizing as much as they used to. So anyway, that hopefully answers the question.
It does. And so that's let's go to the cycle, the model you just more or less described, and that is, that had been the model that we've used for many years, and it's where usually a younger woman is found, and she goes through the stimulation cycle, which Dr. Massey described, you know, with injections and whatever, and then the recipient has the however many eggs, and often it's a fair number of eggs because these are younger women, and with no fertility issues. And then they make the decision, as Dr. Feinberg mentioned, of whether to freeze the eggs or whether to fertilize the eggs or whether to split them, fertilize some, creating embryos, and freeze some as eggs. And then once the eggs are fertilized and they become embryos, hopefully, then the decision is made whether when to do a transfer. So we've got that's using a one-on-one. The recipient finds, or the recipient person or woman or couple finds a woman, often through an egg donation agency or through their clinic, and then they that woman stimulates, and they then have all the eggs that the woman produces. So let's talk about some of the advantages to this traditional model. Dr. Massey, what are some of the advantages to the recipient couple or woman finding a young woman who donates, paying her, and then having all the eggs that she has produced in that cycle? What are the advantages to that approach? And is it still done?
Well, frankly, we don't do it much anymore. But I guess the way I would put it is there's an upside advantage if you do it, but there's a downside. So because unless it's a proven donor, you never know really what you're going to come up with in terms of the numbers of eggs. So the upside advantage is that if a donor produces, let's just say, 20 mature eggs, the recipient's going to wind up with enough fresh and frozen embryos to have as many children as she wants from that one donor. I mean, that might be being overly optimistic, but her chances of having a baby from that would probably be in the 90% range. But on the other hand, she's taking some of the risk that the donor can disappoint, and that can happen. So she could wind up with 9 eggs. And so it's our clinic has adopted a model that's more along the lines of a 6-egg scenario or a 12-egg scenario. And
okay, we'll come back to that because I want to finish talking about this model. Okay, so
okay.
Some of the advantages and disadvantages are certainly one of the things to know about this, and I'm going to call it the traditional egg donor model,
mm-hmm.
is that it is less predictable. Joe, do you know what the cost is, just roughly arranged, that the cost for this type of egg donation model is?
I'm going to say $25,000.
Okay.
What is it? Y'all do it? Ron, do you do traditional?
Well, I think the whole model has changed in large part because of egg banks and egg banking.
Right.
Yeah, we're going to come to that in just a minute. Yeah. So
no, I know, but that that impacts. I mean, we now have a renewed appreciation of the value of eggs, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So, if an egg donor is a high producer of eggs, you may not really want to put the recipient in a position of having so many eggs that they end up with embryos that they're not sure what to do with down the line.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so it actually becomes somewhat wasteful in the fresh egg arena. And so there's also the fact that we've just gotten a whole lot better at working with donor eggs as we have in general with IVF. So I tell my patients that I think no one, or it's unlikely that anyone would need more than 6 to 12 fresh eggs to help them achieve a pregnancy. And in fact, because egg banks do sell eggs in lots of 6 typically, and lots of people get pregnant from 6 frozen eggs, I think 6 to 8 fresh eggs is probably sufficient for most people, depending on their desire for, you know, basically deciding how many babies they might want from a group of eggs that they're using.
If they have, if they have 8, are you saying that that is likely enough for, to use the vernacular, an heir and a spare, to have a child and a sibling, to have 2 children? Is that would, if you've got young donor eggs, is that what you're, my understanding is that what you're saying? 8 would be enough
I think 6 to 8 is sufficient for most people to have 1 baby.
Yeah,
and they'd have a pretty good chance of having 2. But if somebody knows going into it that they're going to want 2 children, I would probably steer them towards 8 to 12 eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Because also there's commonly the desire to have genetically matched siblings.
Exactly.
So, but I think it's rare that people would need more than 12 eggs. So if you have an egg donor that's producing 20 eggs or 25 eggs, do you really want to have all those eggs fertilized on behalf of one recipient? And plus, the costs of putting an egg donor through a cycle and the medications and everything else, I think the estimate Joe gave is a little bit low for a one-on-one donor match, especially if somebody needs an agency to identify a donor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think what a lot of recipients ask us, why is egg donation so expensive? And I explain to them that the actual costs to the clinic to put a donor through a cycle can range from $15,000 to $20,000 or more,
mm-hmm.
just the costs. So, you know, prices go up from there, unfortunately. So that's where I think the whole field has looked at it and said, how can we be a lot more efficient with the use of fresh eggs? And actually, the little brainchild that Joe and I came up with, our egg donor collaborative, looked at ways that how can we be more efficient initially with fresh eggs. So,
yeah,
gosh,
I'm just saying,
if there's recipients that happen
mm-hmm.
to be in 2 different clinics, then it creates a natural situation for egg sharing. And I'm sure you want to. I'll defer back to you for the questions
okay.
that I want to ask about that.
All right. So for the traditional model, some of the it's a less predictable. You're not sure how many eggs you're going to get. And Dr. Feinberg, I was really thankful that you mentioned very often that people, when they're first thinking about egg donation, do not recognize that having too many embryos, then that's after you've fertilized the eggs, of course, but having too many embryos at the beginning, everyone is thinking the more the better. The more every embryo is an increased chance that I will become a parent. And
right.
So they're only thinking of the positive. The downside, or the flip side, is that once you've achieved your desired family size, the excess embryos, for many people, not all, but for many people, weigh heavy on what to do and making decisions.
Absolutely.
About
yep.
that is an issue that I think we as a profession have not spent enough time talking about. And we as an organization, as creating a family, we end up spending a lot of time talking about it because we're who they reach out to when they're trying to make decisions about what to do with these embryos. So anyway, that is certainly a disadvantage, another having too many. Another disadvantage is the cost, which at the very least, probably about $25,000, probably more. An advantage, though, I would say, for talking with patients, if they know they want two or three children, then from their viewpoint, it may be economically worthwhile if they end up with a donor that produces a fair number. And, of course, they may not, that may not happen. As Dr. Massey had pointed out, it's not always a guarantee. But if they want to have genetically related children and they think, well, you know, if I need six eggs to give me pretty good odds of having one, and I want three kids, then if I were to end up with 18 to 20, well, then I'm right in the, and economically it would probably work out as well. So those are, I think I'm doing kind of a brief crib note version of the advantages and disadvantages of the traditional model. Now, I do want to, well, let me just pause a moment and remind everybody that you are listening to Creating a Family. We are the Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit, and our mission is to provide unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. We exist because we have partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, accurate information, and one of our partners is Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of prospective sperm donors to provide the client with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. As Dr. Feinberg just mentioned, we are now going to be moving into talking about shared fresh cycles because, as we point out, sometimes you, especially if it's a donor who has donated before, you may make the assumption that there is going to be a fair number of eggs. So the idea came about quite a few years ago that, well, what if two patients went in together and split the cost of having having a traditional egg donation cycle? So let's talk about, Dr. Feinberg, the idea of a shared cycle. We've got two patients who are splitting the cost of a fresh hiring and paying and going through the process of using a fresh donor. So let's talk about that. First, medically it's going to be very similar. So do you have a feel for the cost would be basically the same, but you'd be splitting it two ways. Is that right, Dr. Feinberg?
Well, no, because the cost to the work that has to be done for the clinic is double, meaning you have two sets of eggs, two sets of sperm, two sets of embryos that are being created.
No, I'm talking about you have one donor, she produces 20 eggs, and so two couples go to, and one gets 10 and one gets 10, that type of thing.
Okay, I guess I misunderstood what you were asking. So what are you asking? Could you repeat the question?
No.
I'm sorry.
The cost, I think, would be basically, and there would be some administrative costs that would increase, but for the most part, it's similar in cost to a traditional fresh donor cycle that we just discussed.
The cost of cycling the donor would be the same, but the actual administrative side of it takes a lot of effort because, the future parents have a lot of very specific needs and desires. So the ability for any given clinic to find or identify two recipients who happen to want to use the same donor's eggs, that can be a challenging phenomenon.
So you've got admin costs you've got to add on. Yeah.
Well, so let's say a given clinic has 20 or 30 or 40 different egg donors available, the odds that there are two recipients coming through willing to bear the cost of egg donation at the same time when one donor at her convenience is able to cycle and produce eggs, that's a tough thing to make happen. I mean, we do it, I guess what I'm getting at is it sounds great in theory, but unless it's a massively sized clinic that has many, many people at any given time looking to do egg donation, sharing eggs from one donor within a clinic is a tough thing to pull off.
Logistically is what you're saying, and I hear your point.
Logistics, correct. Yeah.
It also negates some of the advantages if for the families who are wanting to do egg, you know, wanting to guarantee as much as possible that they can have two or three children from the same donor. That would it would be a disadvantage to them to share because that reduces their odds. Somewhat of a cost.
Yeah, you're really lining up three different parties potentially to make something happen. It's kind of like a solar eclipse almost. Yeah, so it happens, and we do it. And the other thing is that popular donors are popular donors. So a donor that, you know, is sought after by one intended parent or set of parents might be well sought after by another. I think one of the thoughts behind egg sharing is where a situation where if there's a mechanism to have recipients who wouldn't necessarily be at the same clinic be able to share eggs, that would be a more efficient way to approach things. Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah, that makes sense.
But yes, I mean, shared eggs is alive and well. Lots of clinics, most clinics try to offer that if they possibly can. But I think what's spurred the rise of egg banks is the fact that there are many people who would love to do sort of a shared egg experience due to somewhat lower costs, but just don't have a buddy to share eggs with.
Yeah.
So, you know, if eggs are frozen, then by definition, that's egg sharing. It's just delayed egg sharing.
And that's a really good intro to the next thing, which I want to talk about, which is egg banks. And which, honestly, egg banks have truly revolutionized, I think, the way we do egg donation for infertility. So let's talk. Dr. Massey, what is the general cost? Well, first of all, explain the concept of an egg bank. I think it seems obvious what we're talking about, but it probably isn't. It only seems obvious to us because we swim in these waters. So, Dr. Massey, what do we mean by an egg bank? And then what is the general cost?
Well, generally speaking, I mean, an egg bank is set up to take advantage of the efficiency of our relatively new ability to freeze eggs reliably. And for the reasons that Ron was addressing, getting all the eggs from a donor is inefficient. And another aspect of that is that fresh donors are sometimes basically take a long time to get organized and done. So clinics for the past about 10 years have acquired the technology to be able to freeze eggs well, and the ones who have created egg banks basically invest in cycling donors at their convenience. Let's just say students might want to do it in the summertime. They might harvest their eggs in the summertime when they're out of school, and they're in graduate school, just for example. They harvest the eggs and they make an investment in doing that process, and then they have an inventory of eggs which are then quickly available to recipients who decide, well, they want to do this in January, now it's December, and they don't really want to wait till it's convenient for a particular donor to do this in February or March. They've been through a lot of delays with their own fertility issues, and now they're ready to move on. And so There's a speed of access element, and then there's also the ability to take 6 or 12 eggs and make it cost effective. So then, how much does it cost? Basically, it's really not it's not saving, well, it's saving money compared to, say, like if you had a fresh cycle, one donor that was $28,000, you can save some money and get the cost down into the low 20s if you take 12 eggs from a donor from an egg bank. The egg banks basically charge a set price for a set of eggs, and then some of them offer eggs at 1 and 2 in addition to the base number of eggs. So y'all do eggs. You do.
Wait, just a second, Joe. Before we do they freeze the eggs in groups of 1, 2, or 6?
Well, they're individually, typically individually frozen, but then they're the sort of the price packages, I guess you would say,
yeah,
are in
okay.
groups of 6 and 12. No, they don't put them all together in a little group. They're frozen on these little devices, usually one at a time, sometimes two at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So Ron can address, because I don't have an egg bank specifically. So Ron, you do, right? So price.
Yeah, so even before we get to that, I think what's emerged are really two different types of egg banks. One I would call a centralized egg bank, which would be a commercial enterprise that has a mechanism to have eggs retrieved either at their own facility or possibly outsourcing to other clinics. But basically the eggs all live, as it were, in one centralized facility. And I would say the other type of egg bank are clinic-based egg banks, or I guess you could call them decentralized egg banks. So there's no special magic to the eggs that are frozen at a centralized egg bank versus a decentralized egg bank. What a centralized egg bank may offer is a larger selection, because they've made their business model such to constantly maintain a certain inventory of eggs to keep up with their own demand. A decentralized egg bank might be what a clinic sort of accumulates over time. Either they are passively accumulating frozen eggs, meaning, you know, a fresh donor goes through and maybe 12 eggs are given to a recipient, but there's another 6 eggs that aren't spoken for, and then those could go into the clinic's egg bank. Or a clinic decides, hey, this is a really great donor. She's been popular before. We don't have a recipient at the moment who might want to use those eggs, but we feel pretty confident that if we cycle the donor because it's summertime and she's a student, someone will come along and want to use her frozen eggs. So to a certain extent, there's overlap to those models. So there are clinics that have decentralized egg banks that contribute eggs to a centralized egg bank. We were in a position like that for a period of time. Now, actually, through the Egg Donor Collaborative, we're actually a hybrid, so that mm-hmm. We have clinic members who have their own eggs available but are willing to carry out embryo creation for a recipient that might be at a different clinic within our network. So it's different than, you know, just a single clinic's eggs versus a centralized egg bank. So it's kind of a hybrid. But I don't know if we're getting off what you originally asked, but I think the egg banks, as far as cost, it's a marketplace, and I think frozen eggs have been around for a while, and I can't speak to what any given egg bank charges, but it seems to me that the value of a mature egg that's frozen has centered in around $2,500, give or take a few hundred dollars.
But you keep in mind that you have to buy, I suppose you could just buy two. I generally hear of people buying more. Do people just buy two, I hear what Dr. Massey is saying, people buy in groups of 6. So that would be kind of your typical.
Yeah, but there are so-called odd lots. In fact, one really great story. Was through the Egg Donor Collaborative, was working with a patient in, I'll just say in the South, so I won't even say what state. It wasn't Georgia, but it was another state in the South. We were working with a very nice patient who was in her late 40s, and she had tried IVF, and she was just tapped out financially. And she went through the Egg Donor Collaborative and identified a donor that was actually here in Delaware, whose eggs had been previously frozen. And we knew those eggs had done pretty well for a couple of other recipients, so we felt fairly confident in the eggs. But she was so tapped out financially, she could really only afford to buy 3 eggs. And it turned out we had a so-called odd lot where we were willing to allow her to use 3 eggs. So what happened was her husband shipped the sperm to Delaware, frozen sperm, and we thawed the 3 eggs, and actually I believe we ended up, all 3 eggs survived. We created 2 nice blastocysts, shipped those blastocysts back to her home clinic, and wouldn't you know it, she conceived after years of infertility and years of trying IVF on her own. So in theory, 1 egg could help somebody get pregnant. But I think the field has settled into the fact that probably 6 eggs is a reasonable number of frozen eggs to give someone a fairly decent shot at achieving success. I will say, though, that part of the downside of frozen eggs is some women's eggs just don't freeze well. And that number is estimated to be about 10 to 20% of women. Their eggs may be great when they're used fresh, but they just don't work very well frozen. They either don't survive the freeze and the thaw, or they do survive, but when they are fertilized, they just don't produce good quality embryos. And even the top-notch experts are scratching their heads trying to figure out what's really happening at the cell level to some of these eggs that's making them not able to do well in the frozen state. I mean, it has implications for women doing elective egg freezing, you know, for fertility preservation and all of that. It may be someday we'll discover a genetic marker or something that we could say to a woman, your egg should do fine to freeze, but somebody else maybe not so well. So that's part of the downside of using frozen eggs, is there's a level of unpredictability. I think most of the egg banks, whether centralized or decentralized, will put some kind of warranty or guarantee on the eggs, and that's built into the price so that, you know, when somebody purchases a group of eggs, either from a clinic or an egg bank, there's usually some quote-unquote warranty behind it, meaning the eggs would be replaced if, you know, if things went bad.
Right. Or, you know, pregnancy, or you can come back and can get another set of eggs if no pregnancy results. All of those are, you need to check with your clinic or the egg bank, whomever, wherever you're using it. Okay, so that's, we've talked about egg banking. Let me just pause a minute to remind everyone that you're listening to Creating a Family, and we're talking today about the current options available in egg donation. And we are talking with Dr. Joe Massey. He is a RE, reproductive endocrinologist, with the Servi Massey Fertility Institute in Atlanta. And we are talking with Dr. Ronald Feinberg. He is with the Reproductive Associates of Delaware. He's an RE with Reproductive Associates of Delaware. And they are the co-founders of the Egg Donor Collaborative. All right, so now we've gone through let me pause a moment and say, and let me thank another one of our partners who, it is through their generosity and their belief and their support in what we do that we're able to bring you this show. One of those partners is IntegraMed Fertility. They are the largest network of fertility practices in the country. By combining the latest innovations in the reproductive sciences with compassionate and customized treatment plans, IntegraMed practices are able to provide the very best possible care. All right, back to our talking about the current options in egg donation. We've talked about the traditional fresh model. We've talked about sharing a fresh donor, so the shared fresh traditional model. Then we've talked about egg banks. And you mentioned it was, Dr. Feinberg, you mentioned that the Egg Donor Collaborative is a kind of a hybrid, and there are probably some others out there that also are different. Different. So, Dr. Massey, what does the Egg Donor Collaborative do that is a hybrid between the centralized and the decentralized, and what are the advantages there of that model?
So, well, the Egg Donor Collaborative really isn't a bank. It's I think of it as a portal of entry into multiple lanes of access, I guess I would say. So there are over 300 donors listed from a variety of centers around in the eastern part of this country, and each of them has their own donor pool. But some of the donors are available fresh, some of them are frozen, some of them, for example, from our clinic, if they're frozen, it's usually on the passive model that Dr. Feinberg talked about. We don't deliberately freeze eggs, but sometimes we have leftover eggs that we freeze. But so from the recipient standpoint, it in a way it doesn't really matter, I think, exactly what the model is for the particular clinic. So each of the centers provides a listing. Patients can go online and look at the donors and pick them by their own specifications, hair color, eye color, we don't usually use eye color, but hair color, education, athletic ability, musical ability, whatever they're looking for. And they look at profiles online and then make a selection. And it doesn't matter really from the recipient standpoint where the donors are, because what happens is embryos are created, let's just say, for example, in Delaware or Atlanta, and shipped to a recipient, and a recipient could be really anywhere. They can have embryos shipped to their own home center as long as those centers are willing to collaborate with us.
Is the main advantage then that it opens up the pool of potential donors that you're looking for, and you get a choice between whether it's a frozen cycle or a fresh cycle, or whether
yes.
you're using it frozen or fresh. So
yep.
as opposed to just working with your own clinic, you're now working with X mm-hmm. number of clinics who are part of the collaborative. Is that am I summarizing it correctly?
Exactly. So, so each of the clinics is agreeing that, let's just say, a recipient only wants 6 eggs from a donor who doesn't have any eggs banked, then these centers agree to let her have 6 eggs harvested fresh, and then they would retain and freeze the other eggs themselves.
Gotcha. And because embryos are routinely frozen, once fertilized, in fact, there's some evidence would indicate it's even preferable, at least when the woman is the one being stimulated, it's preferable to freeze. So it's really no disadvantage at this point even if it's a fresh egg. Once it's fertilized, it's going to be frozen. It will be shipped to your home clinic. So it's
right.
It's taken away the person having to travel. The recipient
right. So,
has to,
right. So one of the models that we didn't talk about, Ron touched on it earlier, was agency donors. Agency donors typically are a very expensive option for patients. Let's just say a recipient has just got to have a 6-foot-tall, blonde, athletic donor. Well, the agencies sometimes have provided these donors, but they travel from Kansas to Delaware and charge an agency fee plus a donor fee, and that's gotten to be very expensive. So the embryo creation model addresses that inefficiency, i.e. the inefficiency of agency donors who are traveling. That goes away. You can ship embryos, albeit not free, because it costs $700 or $800 a shipment. But basically, compared to shipping a donor across any kind of geography, it's much more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, fascinating. And opening up, and let's talk about cost. Is there a cost advantage, or is it mainly an access advantage? Dr. Feinberg?
So, I mean, I find most people are very cost conscious, and that is totally to be expected. But I think the number one priority for most of the intended parents that we take care of is to find the donor that they're happiest with. And so, I mean, you can think of the Egg Donor Collaborative is a little bit like a dating service. So, you know, if I have a donor that's the dream donor for one of Dr. Massey's intended parents, well, they wouldn't have known about one another otherwise. And the beauty of the collaborative is we have a centralized listing. It's totally free. I mean, it's open, available to the public. Anyone can view the donors. In fact, we get a number of inquiries from people who are not affiliated with a particular clinic, or they are, and you know, it just creates all kinds of interesting matches to really hit the highest priority that intended parents have, and that's to find a donor they're happiest with. So, as far as cost goes, we really don't think the cost is all that much different to the intended parent than if the donor was actually right at their own clinic. Because, as Joe alluded to, yes, there has to be a shipment of sperm to the receiving clinic to create the embryos, and then embryos have to be shipped to the clinic where the intended parent is being taken care of. But those costs are relatively low compared to trying to have a donor fly, you know, somewhere across the country, stay put, you know, for a number of days in a place where she's being cycled. And, oh, by the way, agencies don't create donors for free either, so agency fees have to be figured into it, and that can be, you know, several thousand dollars. So I think the agency model is still a great model for lots of people. And so we're not looking to replace the agency model. We're looking to supplement the entire donor egg arena and basically to give intended parents the best choice they can. So we basically have clinics that wear two different hats. The donor host clinic is the clinic that's caring for a donor, and the recipient clinic is the clinic that's caring for the intended parent. But members of the network would probably in most cases do both. They may have donors that they're willing to cycle and can cycle, and they have their own patients who are intended parents. And the collaborative isn't looking to replace any other model. It is looking to replace centralized egg banks. It isn't looking to really nudge aside any of the existing models that exist in the egg donation world. It's just really about giving our patients more choices. And it's worked well. I mean, we started the collaborative. I think it's been about a year and a half now. We've had several pregnancies that we're all feeling great about because they wouldn't have happened otherwise if it hadn't been mm-hmm. for the collaborative. We think there's a lot of potential. We are chugging along. We're open to having more clinics join the network. And honestly, for Joe and I, it's been a labor of love. I wouldn't say we're a not-for-profit organization like your organization, Dawn, but we're really looking to expand the care options for people that want to grow their family. That's really the goal. It looks like we're on the right track. We'll see. You'll have to have us back in a year and give you a progress update.
Progressing. Well, it does. It seems like it's a good option for, at least for people who are looking for an egg donor. It increases their pool of people to look for.
Yeah.
Dr. Massey, before there's another option we need to talk about, just briefly, I think, but that is going abroad for an egg donor. I'm not hearing it as much chatter amongst the patient community. I think the main advantage there is cost. So But there are definitely some disadvantages and as well. Can you talk to us just briefly about the option of going abroad?
Well, I would agree with your point that it's not sort of a buzzword anymore to do it. I know that it's done. I have very few people who come in and say, well, they decided to go to Czechoslovakia and do this. I have had some, and they're happy. I mean, basically, I think they're getting good care. They have to go abroad for a while. One of the disadvantages is if they don't get pregnant the first time, are they going to go back for the frozens, or are they going to ship the embryos back over here? That question arises.
The recipient goes abroad for the frozen embryo transfer or fresh embryo transfer.
Medical procedure
is abroad?
Yeah, what they do is the couple goes abroad and the husband gives sperm, and then they wait and do a transfer 5 days later. So,
okay.
And they don't know exactly when it's going to happen. But sometimes they use frozen eggs. But basically they go over there and do entire process. Yeah.
Right. And is it possible to ship frozen embryos back to the United States?
It is. Yeah.
Okay.
It is now. Let's think about this. Wait a minute. In order to put them back in this country, don't they have to be STD tested?
I think it would be a very complicated thing to do.
Wait a minute. Let me see. Let's think about it a minute. You can't ship the embryos back here and have them tested and have them transferred. So I would correct myself. You can't because the donors haven't had FDA testing.
Okay.
Okay. So,
important.
We haven't really addressed that issue, but all the donors are screened very carefully, and one of the things they're screened for is sexually transmitted diseases.
Mm-hmm.
The STD testing for an egg or sperm donor, for that matter, the testing has to be done in an FDA-approved lab, so the European donors aren't screened that way.
Okay.
So they can't bring the embryos back because the clinics can't put them in. Yeah.
And so there is the if you're thinking about this as an option, you need to consider the turnkey costs, the full costs, which would include travel, as well. So those are, I think sometimes people just look at the cost of what getting eggs. And then you need to be careful that from an ethical standpoint that the women are being, the donors are being treated well and with respect and have full consent and all of that. So those are things that you need to think about when going abroad. All right, so we've covered the whole waterfront here of possible options. Egg donation is absolutely something that we get a lot of questions on. And as you point out, it has a lot of uses. The majority of people who are asking us are women who are 40 and older. But as Dr. Massey says, people with low ovarian reserves, which can happen in a much younger age, as well as single men or couples who are uterine challenged, which is a phrase I'm now going to pick up. Let me pause just a moment, and we're coming into the season of giving, and I just want to put out a plug here. Everything we do, including the show at Creating a Family, exists because of the support of people just like you. And if you are a listener to this show, we would love to have you make a donation. Doesn't have to be a big one. Any donation is so appreciated. You can make that at our website, creatingafamily.org, in the upper right-hand side. There's a place there for you to donate. I wanted to read you an email we had received from somebody. And just to remind us, and it does help to remind us that we are making a difference in people's lives, this came from a woman named Joanna. Your podcast has been my saving grace, a source of fantastic and helpful information, and a daily therapy session. So thank you, thank you, thank you for dedicating your time and energy to women struggling with infertility. We so appreciate your research. Thank you, Joanna, and I hope those of you who are listening will also remember us in your end-of-year giving, creatingafamily.org. Keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility professional. Also, the views expressed in this show are those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our sponsors, or our underwriters. Now, I know people are going to want more information about both of the doctors that have been on today, as well as the Egg Donor Collaborative. For the Egg Donor Collaborative, you can go to their website, eggdonorshare.com, eggdonorshare.com. And for talking with Dr. Feinberg, you can go to his website, IVF-DE, that's for Delaware, IVF-DE.org. And for Dr. Massey, you can go to his website, which is IVFGA, that the GA is for Georgia, so IVFGA.com. Thank you so much for listening to us today, and we will see you next week.
Come to the Home Depot this month, and you'll learn a thing or two. Actually, three, with three free do-it-yourself workshops. Learn how to design and care for your container garden by selecting the best soil and aesthetically arranging your plants. Learn how to install tile flooring, even how to keep your outdoor deck and patio space in the best shape possible. See, it's never too late to learn something new. Register today at homedepot.com/workshops for a do-it-yourself workshop near you. Only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing.